Hello, and welcome to another spine-chilling episode of Beyond the Unknown. I'm your host, Jolie.
And I'm Quinn.
And today, we're diving deep into the disturbing case of missing and murdered men in Indiana. This is the story of killer Herb Baumeister, a man whose suburban facade concealed a horrifying secret. Herb Baumeister, the eldest of four, was born on April 7, 1947, in Indianapolis, Indiana. Herb had a seemingly normal childhood, playing around the suburbs with his siblings and neighbors. But things changed when he was around the age of 10, as Herb started to demonstrate signs of antisocial behavior, and he had urophilia, which is the sexual interest in urine.
Didn't know that had a name?
Yeah.
Okay.
Me neither until I saw that word.
So clearly, like, that is, like, a broad sexual interest then, like, beyond the whole concept of a golden shower.
Yeah, but that was kind of the main term that came up.
Oh, okay.
Gross. Yeah. But some of his childhood friends recall him talking about how he was interested in what the taste of human urine would be like. And he talked about it a lot. So that's where his urophilia came in.
Oh, okay.
The interest in urine escalated to urinating on teachers' desks at school and then crossed into the realm of playing with dead animals.
Ugh, that's never good.
Yeah. Alarmed by his behavioral change, Herb's father took him to a psychiatrist who diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia and antisocial personality disorder.
There is no personality disorder more scary than antisocial personality disorder.
Why? What is it like?
It just basically means that you, I'm going to butcher this, but in some, like someone who has that doesn't really have empathy and does basically all the things that we understand to be like things that we think are wrong and we know inherently and morally are wrong, like hurting someone or doing something against someone's wishes or burning a building down. That doesn't bother them. That doesn't cause emotion. They don't feel stressed to do that or guilt after having done that. It's a very scary, yeah.
Wow, okay.
Like they actually just don't feel it. It's not that they're not bothered. Like they're like, oh yeah, it was bad, but whatever. They don't see it that way.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then you're not going to love the next bit of this where after he was diagnosed with these two disorders, he was not administered any treatment. And his father didn't see the need to do anything further with this information. So Herb just got worse.
It's not surprising.
Especially given the time period.
Yeah.
He withdrew even more from social interaction within and outside of school, which is no surprise. And after high school, Herb joined and left two college programs before giving up on the college track and starting his career, bouncing around from place to place. Many who worked with Herb noticed his excellent work ethic, but with very unusual and erratic behavior. He eventually founded a thrift store chain called Save-A-Lot in Indianapolis, which would be the focus of Herb's career.
That's actually like a pretty big thing to do. Like he's actually owning and operating a business. Okay.
In November of 1971, Herb married Juliana, or Julie, Sater. And after 6 months, Julie reached out to Herb's father because she too noticed that his erratic and alarming behavior was out of control. So Herb was committed to a psychiatric hospital for 2 months. And then once he returned home, he seemed better, but he wasn't what we'd consider to be, quote, normal. Julie recounted that over their 25 years of marriage, where they conceived three children together, they had sex only 6 times, and she never, ever saw him nude.
So did they do it in the dark or like fully clothed?
No idea.
Interesting. Okay.
25 years.
That's a long time to go. Poor Julie.
Yeah. Aside from their sexual history, Julie and Herb were a little distant. Herb focused on the business and it was all consuming, and Julie focused on raising the children. So it wasn't uncommon for Julie to take the children out of town while Herb stayed home to work on the business that was slowly failing. Sadly, working on the business was the last thing Herb was doing while Julie and the kids were out of town.
Oh, God.
What he actually was doing was much more sinister.
Surprise, surprise.
That meme. Surprise, surprise.
I can never get enough of that.
But yeah, it was bad.
God.
Around the time in Indianapolis, patterns of a serial killer were emerging. Many young gay men were disappearing around town, and over time, bodies began to appear along Interstate 70, or I-70. It all started when 15-year-old Michael Sean Petrie was found strangled on the side of the road on June 16, 1980, 9 days after he was reported missing. Witnesses had reported seeing Michael in a stranger's vehicle around town, but nobody knew who this person was and if it was even related to his murder.
That's so scary, like for a community, like when things like that start happening, like you can just never feel safe and you're always worried about your loved ones and things.
Exactly. 2 years later, another young man, 22-year-old Maurice Allen Taylor, was found deceased along the same route. Although the autopsy was inconclusive, police suspected the victim was also strangled to death based on the condition of the body. So I think the autopsy just can't say that that was the cause of death, right?
Yeah.
Between 1980 and 1991, 9 more bodies of missing men were found dead by cause of strangulation along I-70.
9? So that's a total now of 11?
Yeah. 11 victims total were found alongside I-70 over an 11-year period, and they all had something in common. All men were homosexual, and they were frequent patrons of local gay bars. And many had been known to solicit sex for money, but not all. And a handful had been seen in a vehicle with a man around the same time of their disappearance. But no one could provide a similar enough story to what this person looked like or the car they were driving. So police didn't have a clear suspect in mind.
That's so frustrating.
11 years.
11 years, 11 people. And then also most people said they saw him with someone, yeah, but they couldn't. Like, that's what's really frustrating is, like, they're always kind of seen with a man, but who's to say it's the actual person that killed them, especially if they were soliciting. They could have been in anyone's car.
Exactly. But so frustrating. Mm-hmm. Around 1991, the I-70 strangler seemed to stop. No more bodies appeared, but that didn't mean the disappearance of gay men had stopped. And while that's because Herb and Julie had actually purchased an 18-acre homestead called Fox Hollow Farms in Westfield, Indiana.
Oh, God.
This farmland was very private. Random aside, but do you know the average American home size in square feet?
Definitely not. And I frequently don't understand square feet in general. But if I had to, like, guess, I'd say like 1,500.
Yeah, it's 2,000. Maybe in Canada it's 1,500. But still pretty close. But their home that they had purchased on this 18-acre homestead was 11,500 square feet.
What? That's like a mansion.
It's a mansion.
And if you had a failing business, how did they do that?
No idea. No clue.
Okay.
And it has my biggest pet peeve, which is when there's a weird ratio to bedrooms and bathrooms. So there were 4 bedrooms, 1 for the parents, and then each of the children to have their own. But there were 10 bathrooms.
I feel like I kind of get it, being in a house that has, like, no bathrooms, that in the sense that there's always going to be somewhere you can go pee. And there's probably a bathroom on each bedroom, plus ones that, like, you don't have to go through your bedroom just to go. Like 10 is extreme. Like, that's insane. Yeah. But it's like, I kind of like, I feel that. I would like 10 bathrooms. Yeah.
I would hate 10 bathrooms to clean.
Ugh, true. 10 toilets. The cleaning. Oh my God. Oh yeah, that's true.
Aside from the bathrooms, this house had an indoor pool, a 5-car garage, and 2 horse stables.
How did they have, like, this is like multi-million dollar territory in terms of house size, like in the sense of, like, you'd have to be very, very wealthy.
Yeah, the size, yes, but maybe that area is cheap because I saw that, you know, it was sold recently and it was under $1 million.
Okay, it must be, because where you are, that's a whole different thing, but where I'm at, under $1 million won't get you that. That'll get you like a typical 3 bedroom home, cut like few bathrooms and like with no land, literally none.
Yep. So sorry for the rant on the house, but back to Herb and his activity along I-70.
Because lack thereof.
Yeah, or now lack thereof. Because he now lived on a gigantic secluded property, he didn't need to dispose of his victims along the highway anymore. 2 years after the I-70 strangler supposedly vanished from police radar, men started to go missing again, and the disappearance came in waves, seemingly in higher numbers between the spring and summer months, and police had no idea who was behind it, or if it was even one person. That is until 1994, when a man named Tony Harris alerted police that a man named Brian Smart, who frequented gay bars in town, might have been behind the disappearance of his friend Roger Goodlett, who went missing on July 22, 1994. Tony didn't just pull out this hunch from thin air. He suspected Brian Smart as the potential killer because not too long before Roger Goodlett went missing, Roger told Tony that he met this guy Brian at the bars, and they both went back to his mansion on a large property, and there he was almost strangled to death with a pool hose during an erotic asphyxiation session. Roger and Brian were then seen at multiple gay bars since the incident, and then Roger vanished.
So he, like, didn't always intend to kill them? Or it was just luck that he didn't die the first time?
I think it's luck.
Okay.
But maybe it could be both.
Interesting. Okay.
So police finally had a potential suspect, because Tony had seen Brian Smart, and Brian Smart had a story with Roger potentially killing him, learning about his mansion, and then he disappears after they've been seen together quite a few times after. But Brian Smart couldn't be identified, no matter how hard they searched.
Surprise, surprise. Sorry, I stopped saying that. Oh, no shit, he used a fake name.
Yeah. And Tony Harris wasn't letting this guy get away. He was on the lookout for Brian Smart. And finally, one day in August of 1995, he saw him again in his vehicle. And this time, he wrote down his license plate. He gave the police the license plate information, and they were able to trace the vehicle to a local businessman. None other than Herb Baumeister.
Nailed ya.
Police requested a search of Fox Hollow Farms, but Herb and Julie declined because they didn't have a warrant and they really didn't see a cause to do so. Or at least, you know, Julie didn't.
Was Julie in on it?
Not that we can tell.
I'm always like a little suspicious of the significant others who claim they didn't have any idea, but fair enough.
I agree. But I would be more lenient for Julie because over their 25-year marriage where they had sex 6 times, true. I'm assuming they are very distant and like he's all, you know, business focused and she's just like, I guess I'll take care of the kids and entertain myself because we have nothing else to do with each other.
True. And they have such a big property. He probably just was off doing his own thing at all times. So that's fair. I just, when she declined the warrant too, like to me, if someone came to our house and said, we have a warrant to chat, I'd be like, go for it. Like, or yeah. Don't have a warrant. I'd be like, search. I don't have anything to hide, you know?
Yeah.
Like I know there's obviously risks of doing that. Even if you don't, they might find things and like, yeah.
Pin maybe it
I
to
wouldn't
you.
Say yes, yeah. But yeah. Okay. Maybe I wouldn't. Okay. Now that I like talk this out loud, I'm like, okay. I see where she was coming from.
Yeah. Exactly. But not long after the police visited, Julie became scared of Herb because his behavior was getting more and more erratic, and she eventually filed for divorce. During this time where his behavior was getting more unusual and she had some time to reflect on the past, she remembered that while her sons were playing in the field on their property, get this, their son had found a fully intact human skull.
How do you like have to sit and like really think about that? Like that's like to find animal bones is one thing. To find a human skull, I would never forget that. And when the police came to say we want to search the property, I'd be like, there was a human skull back there. Like, come see this.
Yeah. So you might think that, but it wasn't like, oh no, the previous landowners might have been murderers. We found human skull on the property. It was actually played off by Herb, saying that this was a skeleton from his father's medical office, since his father was an anesthesiologist, and they had apparently held on to it, but, you know, Julie had never seen it, And supposedly while he was clearing out the garage, he just thought, I'll bury it. That was his story.
I mean, I might buy that, because what else are you going to do with a human skull? It belonged to someone, and burial's considered, you know, like what most people want to have done when they pass. It does actually seem like the respectful thing to do if that was a true story.
All right, well, be concerned if Chris says this to you.
No, but I just mean, like, there was like a time where it wouldn't be weird for like a doctor to have random.
Yeah, but he's not a doctor and his dad's still alive. So it's like, why do you have it?
Okay, I thought maybe the dad had passed on and he didn't inherit his belongings. Because if I inherited someone's, like, I wouldn't know what to do. I think the respectful thing would be to bury it, but also make sure it wasn't, like...
Wouldn't you donate it to another doctor?
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true, like, for science or something. So, yeah, okay.
Pat, I don't know.
I don't know. It's a weird one.
Yeah, like, what you're saying makes sense. But I'm also, like, wouldn't that just get passed around the medical community rather than, like, to my son?
If you're ever told by anyone after I pass that I had skulls, I don't. So look into that. I don't. Those are not in my possession. So if someone gives you a skull and says it was mine, report it.
Yeah, I will. But apparently that was all that they needed to put that concern to rest. So they never talked about the skull anymore. It wasn't an issue. It was just, you know, an old medical piece.
Okay.
But now that Julie had time to think about it and the police visit and thinking about all of these missing men, she's thinking it was something more sinister. While Herb was out of town in June of 1996, Julie allowed police to search the property. And what they found was shocking.
Ugh.
They unearthed the remains of 11 men from shallow graves, 8 of whom were identified, and they found over 10,000 fragments of human remains that were unidentifiable, that did not belong to those 11 bodies.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Immediately, they put out a warrant for Herb's arrest. And when he got word of that, the police had found the bodies, he fled to Ontario, Canada, where he committed suicide by gunshot at Pinery Provincial Park on Lake Huron.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it escalated quickly.
Okay.
He left a 3-page suicide note, which he detailed his regret for, what he was about to do at the public park, his sadness for his broken marriage, and his failing thrift store business. But he failed to mention any of his victims or crimes committed.
That's so frustrating. Like, frustrating is not even the right word. Like, if I was that, like, one of the victims was one of my family members, like, I would want him to have said something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super unusual, especially like a 3-page suicide note. Why did you feel the need to flee and do this?
Yeah, like, you obviously killed those people. That's why you killed yourself.
Yeah. In 1996, they tied Herb Baumeister to the 11 victims on his property and the 11 along I-70. But police suspected there were more victims. And in October of 2023, 30 years later, victim Alan Lee Livingston was identified as one of the sets of remains on the property. So one of the actual, like, intact bodies that they found. And he went missing on August 6th, 1993.
Is that before they moved to the house?
No, they moved.
Oh, okay.
In like 88, but they arrested him in 96. Or sorry, they didn't arrest him. They put out his warrant for arrest in 1996.
Okay.
On January 25th of 2024, they identified another victim, Manuel Resendez, from the remains. So not the bodies, but I think some of the, like, fragmented remains that they had. Mm-hmm. And they're still trying to ID as many victims as possible from the 10,000 fragments that they have. So police are not giving up and trying to identify these victims, because Herb Baumeister, to their knowledge, could be maybe like the biggest serial killer in North America.
Yeah. And honestly, just to have some closure for people wondering where their lost or missing loved ones are, like, even though you don't want that to be the case, it is still closure.
Mm-hmm. Police believe that Herb buried at least 25 bodies on the Hollow Fox Farm property between 1988 and 1996. But there could be more.
And the fact that you said it's for sale, I would never want to buy this property. I couldn't.
Yeah. I'm assuming that that's probably also why the price was so low, but yeah. It was under $1 million. And I thought that's crazy, especially reading how much came with the property.
I bet it's got to be related because I could not, because I bet you there's some stuff they didn't uncover that accidentally you might stumble upon.
Yeah. So that's it. It's worth calling out that this isn't the first serial killer to prey on underrepresented LGBTQ plus community members. And especially during the time where homosexual men were outcasted from society and had little support from police, which made for easy targets for killers like Herb Baumeister, Jeffrey Dahmer, and Colin Ireland, who we'll be covering in a future episode. The case of Herb Baumeister serves as a sobering reminder that evil can lurk in the most unassuming of places, concealed beneath the facade of a happy family man.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Beyond the Unknown. If you have a story you'd like to share, please email us at moody.mediaprod@gmail.com. Or you can reach out on our website, or you can DM us. Who knows, your story might be featured in our next episode.
All of our sources for this episode can be found on our website, beyondtheunknownpod.com. And don't forget, if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and give us a review.
Until next time, listeners, stay curious and remember that the unknown is always just beyond the shadows.
Bye!